I've been dying to do this. It's a tribute with a very special guest, and we're going to be looking at the life and times of Sir Kenneth Arthur Dodd, OBE, born the 8th of November 1927. And sadly, we lost Ken on the 11th of March 2018. Described as an English comedian, singer, occasional actor, and described as the last great musical entertainer, primarily known for his live stand-up performances. Now, a lifelong resident of Knotty Ash in Liverpool, Ken's career as an entertainer started in the mid-1950s, and his performances included rapid and incessant delivery of often surreal jokes. This would go on for several hours, frequently past midnight, and his verbal and physical comedy was supplemented by his red, white and blue tickling stick, often introduced by his characteristic upbeat greeting of "How tickled I am!" He interspersed the comedy with songs both serious and humorous, and with his original speciality, which a lot of people don't realise, you know, ventriloquism.
He's had a migraine. So you stick like that, that's my style. So you've arrived?
Yes.
Pardon?
Yes.
Well, sweetheart, you've got here?
Yes.
And you've walked all the way?
Yes.
Must be very tired.
Yes.
But you're glad to be here?
Yes.
It's for the kids. Can't you say anything else but yes?
Yes.
What is it?
No.
But if you walked all the way, Dick, you must be very tired and very thirsty.
Yes.
Would you like a big bottle of brown beer? What am I next? A big bottle of brown beer and some brown bread and butter or a shandy?
A shandy.
Now are you going to do the alphabet backwards? The alphabet, 26 letters of the alphabet. Are you going to do the alphabet backwards?
He also had several hit songs, primarily as a ballad singer.
Tears for souvenirs are all you left me. Memories of a love you never meant. I just can't believe you could forget me.
And occasionally appeared in dramatic roles, and of course he performed on radio and TV, and popularised the characters of the Diddy Men.
D-I-D-D-Y. We are the Diddy Men.
Now, he was knighted, and it took a long time for him to get his knighthood. And this was in the 2017 New Year's Honours List for services to entertainment and charity. His stage career lasted for over 60 years, and he continued to perform when his health permitted until his death at the great age of 90. Now, I have somebody with me who not only worked with him, knew him very well, but was a great friend of Ken Dodd. And I'm speaking about my good friend, the one and only best impressionist that Britain ever produced, my good friend Paul Melder. Paul, a very good day. Thanks for coming over to do this.
Oh, it's a pleasure, my son.
You know, when Doddy died, I think we all knew he was frail.
Yeah.
We knew that there was the likelihood that, you know, his health was on the way. But I think when he actually died, it was a bit of a shock, wasn't it?
Well, it always is when somebody as famous as Ken and as good as Ken was. It certainly gets to all our hearts, especially if you've known him. If he gets, the older we get, of course, things like pneumonia, which he supposedly had, you get pneumonia and then it's life-threatening, isn't it?
Yes.
So if he passed that, then he would have been weakened. And I think that's what's happened. It weakened him, and really, to look at it sensibly, then it wasn't long before he passed away.
Yeah.
I thought he was on the up. I thought he even sounded as if he was jolly and he was going to last another 10 years or so.
But
obviously wasn't.
I was very surprised, you know, because when we've sat and you've done the Ken Dodd impersonation that you do, you know, you change your face and you do the little mole that he had.
Yeah, he had a little mole on top of his lip, yeah. And when he's talking to you, he used to fiddle with that. You know, when he's talking to you, he'd fiddle with the mole when he's thinking about something or trying to analyse a gag or trying to reproduce a gag. He'd fiddle with this little mole on his top lip. But it was like Tommy Cooper. A lot of people did Tommy Cooper. I did. But then I stopped doing because everybody else started doing him. And then Ken, of course, a lot of people were doing him. And I thought, no, I'm going to stop doing him now. But he was... When you started doing Ken Dodd, there was a lot of laughter in the audience. It was a very recognisable impression.
But in some respects, this is so sad because, you know, you're the expert in this. And we've had people doing some of the greats, Tommy Cooper and obviously Ken Dodd and these other people that have now sadly died. And, you know, we need to remember them and see a proper tribute to them, not somebody who's half doing them, you know. And your Ken Dodd was wonderful. I love watching it, you know.
Let
me just go to Knotty Ash, because this magical place that he created actually exists. And for us both coming from the area, more importantly for you and how you knew him in the early days, tell us about your dad going to the Merseyside Artists Association in Shiel Road. What happened there?
Well, I was only 12, I think. That would be 1948. I think 1948 when I first went to Shiel Road, the sundown, and it was the first time really that my father sat with Ken, a very young Ken then, who was really along with Bert Cook, the comedian. He was the uncrowned king of
Liverpool. I remember.
Yeah, he was the big one.
I worked with him.
Yeah, and I've worked with
him. Oh, I know you would have done, but you know, I thought you'd be surprised maybe that I knew him as well.
Yeah, no, I'm not surprised. I think a lot of people at that time would have known because he was a very, very, very good comic.
Didn't you once tell me a story about how Ken Dodd stood in for him or something?
Well, no, Ken... The story was that Ken he wasn't on the sheet really. Bert Cook, who would never gave up his amateurism, he was in the milk trade then. He was in the industrial side of the milk trade, and somebody had recognised him and said, right, we want him for summer show, and he went to Central Pier. And he was given this summer show, which in Blackpool, you know, you're more or less on your way at that time, and as always. Anyway, he got peritonitis. He got
appendicitis first.
Mm-hmm. And so he was put in hospital. So that put paid to that. So Ken was picked to go on to Central Pier. And from that, he never looked back, because the following year, he went to the Opera House, and that's when I was with the Coronets, four-handed harmony group. We glorified choristers, really. That's when we joined him at the Opera House. That was his first big step in show business. I mean, Central Pier was, but the Opera House was one of the main lines to the Palladium, because a couple of years after that, he went to the Palladium. So I was with him right through that time. I did a birthday show at the Coventry Theatre. And then I did something in Bournemouth. We went back again to Blackpool, I think, doing something in Blackpool. Then we did a lot of charity work together. And he'd always pick me and ask me to come over to the house, sit down, and he'd write these, or ask me to write these little gags he'd give me for my act. Because obviously he wanted me to warm the audience up for him, you know.
Yeah.
But life's full of coincidences. And when I got married, my wife was Dodd. Her name was Dodd, Rose Dodd.
How weird.
Now, I told this to Ken. Yeah. And Ken was very surprised. So her name was Rose Dodd. And she lived in Max Road, Notty-Ash.
Wow.
Now, Max Road, Notty-Ash is at the bottom of Thomas Lane, which is where Ken has lived all his life. I knew his brother, and his mother and his father. Incidentally, his mother and father were real Diddy people. They were very, very small people. His mother was delightful, father as well. And I remember one moment in it when he brought me up. He was doing a show in Warrington, and he asked me to come on and do the show with him. Anita, he was going with Anita then, who was she'd retired from the nursing, but she was an SRN, and she'd retired from the nursing business to go with Ken.
Yeah.
And I was sitting at the table, and it was like home from home. He had all these socks that needed darning or whatever on the table, and he had bits of this and bits of that all over the table, and he had to clear them so his mother would put the dinner down. And he was giving me these lines to say, and to asking me to do Nat King Cole and do this and do that. And he was in the middle of doing something when this bit, his father was leaning over his shoulder, and he had a scythe, and he was sharpening the scythe, and bits of it were falling on his plate. Oh, Dad, for God's sake, look at this all over me dinner. And it was like that. He was sharpening the scythe in the kitchen, which was funny. It was a typical Ken Dodd environment.
Because he was a farmhouse.
Oh, yeah.
Wasn't
it? Oh, yeah. I mean, he had the side of the house. He had a big piece of land that they used to let lorries park on. And they charged them, naturally, to park on those on the land. And it was a delightful cottage. And there's lots of little anecdotes I can tell you about Ken. He was a delightful person to work with. But he was certainly a man who was, he looked after his money. He looked after his money.
How would he have known that you were an impressionist? Where did he first find that out?
I've tried to, in my mind, to think about this, because somebody told him in the show, when I was in the show, because I used to be in the show and I'd go out and do shows. I'd do a pub. They weren't big prop. They weren't cabaret shows then. There was very little around.
Yeah.
And I was really meant for a pub act, you know. So there was loads of pub acts.
I can't think of you as a pub act.
Well, then, yeah, because when you grow in, you become amateur. And I was very, as an amateur, I was. It was all disjointed, but it was entertaining.
Yes.
So I did the impression. I did singing impression a bit and a bit of comedy. Which was really placed, you know, not very good, but it was good enough for people to sort of.
But your dad had also been in the business. Do you think he have told him?
Well, my father was Sandy Franks, and he'd come from the Stanton brothers. They'd retired, and he'd become Sandy Franks. And we used to do a place called Sundown in Shield Road, and that was the first time we went when I was under 12. And it was the very first time I met Johnny Hackett. And Johnny Hackett was dressed in his army gear. He was still in the army then. And he was the entertainer, the top entertainer in Liverpool then. He was, he'd do all the impressions. He did the Nat King Cole and all that then. And he used to do this Maurice Chevalier and all that. And he was very clever, very good. And, of course, he was booked like crazy. And then, of course, there was Bert Cook. There was Sonny Jones, Sonny Day. There was Frank Rosa.
You're bringing so many memories back.
Yeah, Frank Rosa was used to book me, and so did Sonny Day.
Wasn't
Sonny
he
Jones.
Related to Lisa
I was
Rosa?
Going to be, yeah, he was her father.
Yes.
Lisa Rosa's father.
How much is that doggy in the window?
I
can't believe you're saying
I'd
these
work
things.
I worked with her, Lisa, and all of these people would do what they did in She Wrote All This. They'd get up and they'd do a turn. And all the agents would come in and book it. All the diaries would come out if you were any good. And even if you didn't go, if you just went and you made yourself familiar with them, they'd put your name down and they'd say, can you fit in the third or whatever, and at Warrington or New Brighton or wherever you were. They had a pub or whatever. Then.
That was the very first audition that I ever went to. It was Shiel Road. I think it was a Sunday, wasn't it?
Sunday, always on the Sunday.
And there was because without realizing, I'm saying this honestly, without realizing that Ken Dodd had been a ventriloquist. I had a, well, you've got the little ventriloquist doll across here.
Yes, yeah.
I'd got hold of him, and Mary Will's agency, I'd gone around.
Mary Will's, yes, she's great.
Well, I went to Mary Will's.
Mary Will's is great.
I went to her auditions, and she said to me at the end of the audition, she said, the puppet's wonderful, she said, but you've got to go home and practice.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, that was fantastic for a memory for me. I'm going to go back to Doddy and...
Well, Doddy didn't start as a play, but he used to always introduce sometime or other, you know, it didn't happen while I was with him. He didn't start bringing the doll in until much later on.
I don't know if you know this, but I'm looking at, always looking for connections, and I'm looking that he went to the Knotty Ash School and sang in the St. John's Church Choir. Now, he had a fabulous voice, and he was trained, wasn't he, as an opera singer?
Yeah.
So he must have, something from the church has got to have been within him somewhere, because, you know, you obviously get a love of singing, and that's probably where he got that.
Well, Ken liked opera. He loved opera singers anyway. And, of course, he had a love for all the classics, you know, the Shakespeare and all that, so... He eventually was going to do this. He was going to get and do a Shakespeare, the Twelfth Night and all this business. He was going to go into it. Eventually, he did. He started to sing, but he didn't sing opera, of course. Whilst he had that admiration for it, he sang, you know, his what would suit his voice. They were always ballads.
Yeah.
And it was during the time I was with him that he started recording these. In his early days, as I said, it was only 12. That would be 1948 when I first met him. So since then, I only met him through my dad. My dad, I didn't even meet him. My father sat down and chatted with him. And, of course, he said hello to me, you know, being with my father. But that's all I remember of him. I do remember little things like... my father saying that when he was doing a show and Ken was on the show with him, they'd have to wait because if he could manage to get three shows in a night, he'd even do four shows a night on his way to the venue. So he was always late for the venue he was supposed to be at.
Yeah.
He'd make sure he was doing others beforehand. So he'd rake in plenty, you know.
Roughly what year are we talking about for your first awareness of him then?
Well, 1950-51 was the first, you know, real encounter with him.
And can you relate to this? Because I'm reading, I remember you telling me that his dad was a coal merchant. I do remember that. And he went to work for his dad. But apparently he saw an advert in a comic. I've not seen this before, so I'm reading it now. Fool your teachers, amaze your friends, send sixpence in stamps and become a ventriloquist. And apparently his father bought him the ventriloquist dummy, and Ken called it Charlie Brown. Now, did you...
That's right, yeah.
Oh, you knew that?
I knew that.
Because I didn't. I've never seen that before. He started entertaining at the local orphanage and then various other local community functions, and his distinctive buck teeth. Now, did you know where that comes from, the buck teeth?
As far as I know, he's always had those protruding teeth. And
I'm reading this.
And that was his selling point.
I've got to tell you this, because I've never seen this before.
He could eat a tomato through a tennis rack.
His distinctive buck teeth were the result of a cycling accident after a group of school friends dared him to ride a bike with his eyes closed.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that surprised me. That's something I didn't. Oh, that's something I didn't know.
And then he got his professional show business debut as Professor Yaffle Chucklebutty,
yeah.
Operatic tenor and sausage knotter at the Nottingham Empire.
Yeah, that was his. That was.
I mean, that's so funny.
That was his billboard. Name.
Well, on the first bill that he was ever on, Jimmy Clitheroe and Roy Castle were there.
Yeah.
But to go back to this business of,
When I say, you know, so forgive me interrupting, but when I say that my first big encounter, the first one, was in 1960, and that was when he was at the Opera House.
Yeah.
So that's the first time that was when he became big time, you know, when he was on his way, if you like.
Okay, so if I'll put in a little bit of a little bit of his gags here, I think, just to let us lighten the load. And then after that, I'd like to go to this idea of the Djambuti mines. And have you any idea how that all started, the Djambuti mines and the black pudding plantations?
Yeah, these are things he would throw in. And Anita was always very clever with him. If she heard him say things like that, she'd put them down on the board. She always carried the board round. So at times when he was bantering on and talking about this, things would slip out of Ken's mouth that he didn't know anything about, you know. He was amazed at what he said, because they were all some clever stuff. I've always thought that Ken, he could analyse any gag. If you told him a story, he wouldn't be rude enough. He'd do it in a nice way. He'd get the story that you told him, and he'd make it funnier. He would take it to bits and put it together again and give it you back, produced. And it'd be in such a way that it'd be funnier. And the thing that Ken didn't like was expletives. He never liked bad language.
That was marvellous. I love that about him.
He did not like bad language. He didn't even like it as a punctuation for a gag, you know, when to punch the line. He believed that just the line itself was good enough, and if you had the right comedian inflection, then that was enough. And he was a true artist as regards comedy. He really did know his comedy. The cleverest comedy that I've ever known. I mean, besides when we got Billy Connolly to come out, because he went the other way. Of course, he used the expletives.
Yes.
But he used them in an everyday thing. You accepted it from him because it was like the guy in the street or the guy in the pub. But he never thought, Ken always thought, leave that at home. Leave that with your mates.
He never needed it onto
the stage, into the public, because you offend people in the audience.
I mean, when you actually sat and looked at what he did, I mean, it was just rapid fire, and you know, people were falling about, and it was just, I'll tell you about the first time that I ever really became aware of Ken Dodd, and this might surprise you, because it's nothing to do with showbiz for me. When I was I'd be 18, and I was the manager of I was the manager of the supermarket in Market Street, Birkenhead. So I had not been long out of school, 2 years out of school, 18. I'd started to work in this capacity as the supermarket manager, and we ran a competition, and we were going to take a coachload of people as prize winners up to see Doddy in Blackpool.
Yeah.
And I was in charge of the whole thing, taking them up to Blackpool and bringing them back safely, which at the time I didn't probably realise how privileged I was, really. You know, and how he would come into my life after that later on. Let's move on to...
When you talk about Ken, when he produced the gag, Anita with a board didn't have all the gags. He'd go out and do his routine. And Anita, if he threw anything new into a routine or new gags, Anita would tick it or cross it off. And he'd give it three goes. If he got three crosses, then it was taken out and it wasn't used again. And he'd put something else in its place. So he's extreme. He was working on his act all the time. Everything that went into his act was well thought about and well placed. And I remember him saying to me once, we were in the dressing room, I was with another guy, another comedian from Liverpool, and we were talking about comedy and that. And he said, well, comedy, you can't keep an audience bent up laughing for a whole 20 minutes, half an hour, 1 hour. You can't do that. You've got to lighten the load. You give them, make them laugh with whatever you got. Once you've got them on the hook, you've got them on the hook for whatever. But be sensible enough to know when to stop and just to draw it out with a song or do something that's not so funny, just mildly funny, to give them a little rest.
Because last Saturday night, my heart nearly stopped. I was just five numbers off a winning line. I was close as that. I don't know what I'd do if it were the lottery. I'd probably give it all away. No, I wouldn't. I went shop last Saturday to buy a lottery ticket. There was a gorgeous girl behind the counter. She said next week would be rollover week. I said, hello. Oh, that's better than winning 10 quid. I'm in a good mood. Send us a quid. Oh, this is terrible. It gets stress, you know, stress. It affects every stress. You're under stress. I'm under stress. I don't know what I'm under stress for. I'm the only one who knows what time the thing's going to finish. And I don't want to depress you. I'm an optimist. No, an optimist, love. It's nothing to do with your eyes. Did you know this, you know, that 50%, and that's almost half. Well, I know I'm not brilliant at figures. And neither are a lot of people. Do you know that 5 out of 3 people can't do fractions? Stress in children, stress in sports. Any Manchester United supporters in?
Yes!
Always women, isn't it? You know, he's being jealous. They've got Sir Alex Ferguson. Sir Alex Ferguson. The other afternoon, the Queen very graciously dubbed Sir Alex with a golden sword and gave him a gold stopwatch 10 minutes fast. Then all the Manchester United players, they always have on the pitch following their captain. In our house in Notting Hill, the phone rang. I picked up the phone and he said, hello, Ken. Chris Tarrant here, ITV's Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Ken, we have David Beckham here and his wife Victoria, and with your help, we can get them up to £100.
I'm going to try and explain a little bit more why I became such a huge fan of Doddy, because that was the excitement of a young guy basically seeing, you know, something for the first time. And then in 1982, I ran the first Wirral Marathon, and I was working with a group of ladies who had a connection to Ken Dodd. Jean Gray was the lady that I worked with, and she was the leader of the group. And they helped me arrange all the sponsorship money and collect all the sponsorship money. And in 1982, we got £2,280. Ken Dodd came to see us at the Portsmouth Ladies Club, and there I was with another guy in a duo, and John Holford and myself did our, you know, half-hour set or whatever it was. Doddy didn't come because, like he was saying, he'd done gigs on the way in. And then when he did come, he took the cheque, and I've got the photographs of that particular event, which I treasure to this very day. And as you just said, his girlfriend was at in the wings, making a note of all the different...
Yeah,
absolutely wonderful. Now, let's go to his actual career, because a lot of people don't realise this singing voice of his was absolutely marvellous, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's... Again, the training. I don't know. You said he did opera training. I don't know anything about that. I don't know whether he did or not. I know he admired opera singers. He had his own favourites. And I used to say about, talk to him about different ones. And my favourite one then, my one, was Franco Corelli. I loved his voice. I loved his... He had a marvellous way. He'd introduce this back of the throat and the palate, the soft palate, using it, and to be able to adjust the notes at the back of the throat. And he became a master of it. And a fellow called Mario Delmonico, again, two very good, and they were always against each other. But Franco Corelli was my favourite thing. And he didn't know anything about Franco Corelli, and I said to Franco Corelli, and he got a record, and he kept saying to me, oh, it's what a beautiful, and I said, I know, he's a beautiful voice, just had a lovely way of interpreting all of the songs. Of course, since then, we've had Pavarotti and others come into the fray, but he was very much in touch with opera and the classics of Shakespeare, and he's got great knowledge on it. He had good knowledge on all these things. He never spoke... he wasn't silly. He was a good conversationalist. He had a lot of wisdom about Ken. But he always had his own idea on things. He would, you could discuss it with him, but you had the feeling sometimes that he was manoeuvring that to his way of thinking rather than your way of thinking.
I just want to come in for a second, Paul, to explain to anybody who's listening into this podcast and not too sure of your career, because, you know, there have been other people putting their tributes together. Let me just tell any of our listeners that Paul is not only great with the speaking impression, but I think I'm right in saying, aren't you, Paul, that you're one of the few who have the gift of being able to sing like other singers. And, I mean, you do all the Rat Pack and Neil Diamond and these great, great singers, you know, that we've listened to over the years. So when you watch somebody else authenticating, if you like, Ken Dodd, there's a bit of a difference between somebody who's like myself just commenting or asking questions and somebody that's actually done this at the top end of the business, you know, like you have. And therefore, I want to make sure the listeners realise that the tribute that you're putting to him is more from a professional acknowledgement of the wonderful performer that he was.
Yeah, yeah, he... I'm very blessed and I'm very proud of the idea that I was at that time, the early days of 12, when I first met him, but didn't, if you know, and my father just said hello and that was it. But met him in the 50s and then at the age of, in the 60s, in 1960, did the Opera House in Blackpool. And I was very privileged to be able to work with him. Although I was only in the capacity of a sort of chorister, it was a glorified chorister. It was one up from the chorister, if you like. We were a four-handed act and a harmony act. But I got to know him very well. You know, I think all comics are lonely. They all look for company.
Yeah.
And they're very much, they're loners. So... when you offer your friendship or you offer anything, they envelop you, you know, they bring you into them. And I was brought into his company because I had knowledge on around the boards through my father. He knew my father, Sandy Franks. And, of course, through going around the clubs and doing the clubs, he kind of knew a little bit about me as well.
Okay, I want to put you in the picture with something which we're going to play now. And it's basically the fact that he was there at the time the Beatles were just beginning to kick on.
We have always thought that it might be a good question to put to Mr. Kenneth Dodd and the members of the Beatles. To what extent do they attribute their success to their hairstyles? And we'll start by asking that question now of Mr. Ken Dodd.
We call it her in Liverpool, you see. We always have the Judy with the fur her. We have a fellow went into one of those shops once in Liverpool where they sell those, you know, minks and things. And he says, the girl, he said, give us one of those hurry coats. I say, I beg your pardon, sir, what fur? He said, fur the Judy, who do you think?
Do you think that he owes a lot of his success to his hairstyle, fellas?
No, I don't think it helped at all. It probably would have been better if it was bald.
No, but with the teeth, I think the teeth on the hair, all the gimmicks, you know, I think you have to have a, I think you definitely have to have a gimmick.
Oh, about the nose?
You've all got gimmicks, haven't you, Lloyd? Hey? What about the nose?
Yeah.
What about the nose? He's a Martian. Actually, we were writing this film script for the boys. You know, the boys are making this new film, and we've been writing the script, and actually we've cast Ringo in the part of King Charles on account of the... thing, you know, and he goes along to Nell Gwynn and pinches her Jaffas and...
Tell us more about this picture. We didn't know about this.
Oh, picture. Yes, we've written the thing. Oh, all writing different parts. I'm writing the script. I'm writing the script, yes.
New deal.
Yes. with Naughty Ass University, you know, the help of the people, the professors there. He's King Charles. John is a courtier, and in this film he wears a long golden wig with all beautiful curls.
Very nice.
And a blue velvet jacket and like sort of knickerbockers with lace around the bottom and buckle shoes with diamante clips on, and he's sort of walking around on the film set and there's a policeman standing on the side and he said we'll pinch him when he comes on.
What's he supposed to be doing, though? I mean,
well, John, he's a peasant. He's an evil son. Thingy, he's... he's an evil... evil-smelling peasant.
An evil-smelling peasant.
Yeah.
Why is he an evil-smelling... Why is he an evil-smelling peasant?
Come on, stand where I am.
Finished.
Yeah. And Paul is a jester, you see, and he's always making the king laugh. Yeah. Every time he stands in his head, the king laughs like anything. He wears a kilt.
Getting back to this group, Ken, have you no ambitions to form a group yourself?
Love to. Love to with the boys.
Yes.
Kenny and the Cockroaches.
Kenny and the
Cockroaches. And the Diddy Man.
Yeah, what about yourself? Would you
Ringo and the Layabouts.
Would you not form one yourself, Ken?
Yes, I'd like to, yes, because the only thing is I'd have to change my name, you see. I'd have to have a name like Cliff or Rock, something earthy.
Well,
I don't know, eh?
Cliff Dodd.
No.
Rock Dodd.
No, let's invite suggestions for an earthy name for me.
Yeah, well, what about that, fella?
Grass.
Eh?
Sod.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The piece we were just listening to was, you know, typical Liverpool humour with Ken Dodd talking about her and the Beatles, her and all that. What would you have been doing around this time, Paul? Because, you know, I'm trying to put a time frame for myself as well. Round about the time of the Beatles breaking, you know,
64. Yeah.
Because you were on tour as well, weren't you? Didn't you did the Beach Boys? I think was one that you talked about.
Oh, that
about?
Was way after. That
oh, okay.
Yes, that was in the '80s.
So, what did you know of this time of the Beatles and Ken Dodd with his success and Liverpool in general?
Well, first of all, I went. I was there at when he first hit the big, which I call it the first stepping stone, was the Opera House, because the natural progression was from the Opera House to the Palladium. You were going to go in that direction. As if you're picked to do that big venue, then you know you've made it. And of course, Ken came from Central Pier and hit that one, and I was lucky enough to be on that bill with him. Now, later on, I think I'm talking now, that would be around about 1960, something like that, before he made it big, you know,
yeah.
For me, big time. The Beatles, you know, they started coming in about 63, and now at 63, I was with Millicent Martin in Bournemouth, opposite the ABC, opposite the Odeon in. Now, the Odeon, they had the big Sunday concert. We were halfway through the season. Now, Millicent Martin topped the bill. The Kay Sisters were second on the bill. And Tommy Cooper was third. So we towards the end of the show, Millicent Martin had to go away to do Alfie. Halfway through. So they got Vera Lynn in to take over for the last 4 days. Vera Lynn, which was a complete
contrast, really, wasn't it?
Contrast, yeah. So we threw a party for Millicent Martin for the end of show thing, because she'd been absolutely wonderful with us all, really. And we threw the party, and we invited the whole of the show from the Odeon to come, and of course the Winter Gardens as well. Now, in that show was Brian Poole and the Tremolos, the Mersey Beats. The Beatles, and the Beatles were actually third on the bill, but the girls were already screaming for the Beatles.
Yes.
So they were the big ones, they were the big hitters. And they were, anyway, they invited in. And
I've got to get you back to where we're looking at Ken Dodd. So
oh, yeah.
Can you remember anything of how you would do the impression of Ken?
Like everything, when you do an impression, you think of little idiosyncrasies that person does. Say they've got a face that's pulled down, or you know they've got a stutter in the voice, or they've got maybe they tend to flick their hair back, or you're watching little idiosyncrasies that they do. And with Ken, he had this little mole that I told you before,
yeah,
and this little mole on top of his lip, and when he was in deep thought or thinking of a gag or whatever, he'd fiddle with this with his finger and his thumb. And he'd finger it, and he'd, well, young man. And he'd do this, well, young man, this. What do you want to do is, you want to, he'd be, I'm not doing an impression, I'm just doing this the way you do it. And he said, this is the way you want to do it. Now, listen. And he would talk the way he does on stage, but he'd do these little idiosyncrasies with his lip. Nothing else. Nothing else. There was no twitches or anything else, so it was just that little finger, his index finger and his thumb flicking away at this little mole at the top of his lip.
And he was renowned, wasn't he, for being a bit, should we say, careful with his money.
Oh, he,
Because I remember you told me a couple of things that, you know, obviously would highlight this. Wasn't there an end of gift or something?
Well, I did it was 20-odd weeks then. It was a long period. And it was at the Opera House. And he'd always pick on me to do the voiceovers at backstage. I'd have to do a posh voice or Colonel's voice or whatever. And he'd asked me to walk across as a nudist going to on a holiday, you know, with the case and be stripped of the waist and then all sorts of little things. And I'd have to stay back instead of going off and having a drink and something to eat with the lads. I'd have to stay back and do these little things with him, which I was glad to do, really.
Yeah.
And after a while, it did become a thing because, you know, you want that little bit of a rest after doing your act. Anyway, this time he's at the end of the season. He said, "Anita and I have appreciated what you've done, and we said this is a little gift from us." And I opened it. It was a bottle of Old Spice, and I thought, "That's very nice."
Yes,
thank you very much, Ken. I'll treasure that.
He obviously wasn't sort of.
I just loved him. He was a lovely character.
Okay, well, look,
a lovely character.
In finishing this our tribute, because don't forget, there will be other tributes, but I mean, this is a personal one from Paul, who met, worked with, sat in his house, and did a lot of things that other people who claim to know Ken Dodd will never have done. I mean, you know, I met him a couple of times, but I've never been as close to him as you have. What would you say Ken has left us? Would you say he's left us lots of happiness?
Yeah.
Or would you say he's left us tears for souvenirs?
He's left us happiness.
A very big thank you to my good friend Paul Melba. And we've been looking at the wonderful career of the wonderful Sir Ken Dodd.
Happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. To me, this world is a wonderful place. I'm the luckiest human in the human race. I've got no silver and I've got no gold, but I've got happiness in my soul. Happiness to me is an ocean tide, a sunset fading on a mountainside, a big old heaven full of stars above, when I'm in the arms of the one I love. Oh, happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. Happiness is a field of grain, turning its face to the falling rain. I see it in the sunshine, breathe it in the air. Happiness, happiness everywhere. A wise old man told me one time, happiness is a frame of mind. When you go to measuring a man's success, don't count money, count happiness. Oh, happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. Oh, happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. I got more than my share of happiness.